Hi, everybody, and welcome back to NeuroQual Podcast, the show that explores the use of qualitative research methods in neurosurgery. I am Dr. Charlie Whiffin. I'm a senior lecturer at the University of Derby and also a visiting researcher with the NIHR Global Health Research Group on Neurotrauma at the University of Cambridge. And with me today, as usual, is Brandon Smith.
I am Brandon. I'm also a PhD student in the same research group.
Today we are going to be talking to Dr. Tom Bashford, who is chatting to us about his use of unstructured interviews. So we'll let you listen to that and then we'll rejoin and have a bit of a debrief.
All right. So welcome, Tom. Tom Bashford. Very excited to chat to you today. Could you just introduce who you are and what you did for your thesis?
Sure, yeah. So I'm a clinical lecturer in anaesthesia at University of Cambridge. And I completed my PhD thesis in March this year, 2021. And I was looking at how people who do global health think about the practice of that endeavour. So I was interested in how beneficiaries and partners and academics and programmers think about global health and how they structure that in their minds and then in their programs and in their work.
Brilliant. All right. Lovely. Thank you. So you used an unstructured narrative style interview format for your research. Can you just tell us a little bit about how you made that decision?
Yeah, absolutely. So it was this kind of like slow process of discovery. So I work in an engineering department academically, surrounded by systems engineers. And I was particularly interested in systems thinking and how you could use some of the constructs of systems thinking to structure global health work. And so I started thinking about how you understand about how people who are already doing work in the global south to improve healthcare conceptualize what they do. And there are lots of well-described, what are called soft systems approaches within the systems engineering, systems thinking literature. And there's a load of social science and qualitative approaches, you know, that we're familiar to people. People have heard of things like ethnography or rapid ethnographies. So they'll have heard of sort of grounded theory approaches and thematic analyses. And what I struggled with was twofold. One was a straightforward communication barrier that I was obviously working cross-culturally and cross-linguistically. And so trying to translate those concepts was very difficult. And then secondary to that, I was also working with a research team where we were trying to have a very balanced power dynamic. So it wasn't about me going and exploring this purely as the outsider. It was about working with a bunch of friends and colleagues. All my work's based in Myanmar, where they were co-designers and co-leaders of the research process. And what I found was that a lot of the methodological constructs that I was trying to look at or think about using were grounded very much in a Western, you know, North American or European canon of thought and literature and language that really, A, they struggled to translate cross-culturally, but also they placed all of the power and all of the structure in the hands of me as the Western investigator. So that even in the way I was asking the questions and the questions I was positing were bound up in a structure which was all grounded in me and not at all in the place I was interested in working, which was Myanmar. Mm. And so I kind of started to try and strip back to the essentials of, you know, what do all of these approaches seek to do and how can I make that as natural and as easy as possible to work across these boundaries? And I had the sort of the insight that essentially what they all came down to was talking to people to understand their lives and drawing pictures to try to abstract some of that information to make it more tractable and more mutually understandable. And so then I went looking at the ways in which you can understand human experience. And I came across narrative as a kind of an emerging academic technique that's kind of rapidly taken off in the last 20 or 30 years and seems to have suddenly been written about everywhere. Mm. And what that suggested to me was that actually storytelling and understanding narrative is a pretty fundamental part of human communication and doesn't need much translation. Mm-hmm. Similarly, picture drawing, that does vary a bit culture to culture, but actually all cultures around the globe have used image making to understand existence. And they do it in very different ways. Not all cultures make structured maps. Not all cultures use cartoons. But the idea of creating an image or an artifact to help understand reality alongside stories is really common. And so what I decided to do was to use a interviewing technique that, as far as I could tell, what sort of went back to bones. And what I wanted to say to people is, what we're trying to do here is get people to share stories about their life in as much richness and as much candor and as much honesty as you possibly can. And in a way, what I said was, like, we'll worry about the analysis later. What we're going to focus on now is the quality of the data. And just try and get a real understanding of what's going on. And that also came out of an insight I had from having worked in global health for about a decade, which was that the stories you're told very much depend on who you are and when you're asking the question, who you're asking it of. And I knew that the stories that a donor gets told in a nice glossy report are different to the stories which are shared over beer in the bar at the end of the day, which are different to the stories shared at fancy international conferences, and they're different to the stories that are shared in the pages of academic journals. And what I realized was, none of those stories are untrue. Each of them are just a product of a particular interaction. And so what I was hoping to get was a really wide range of stories from different people at different times to different interviewers. Because what I realized was that, from a systems point of view, that gives you this huge kind of superset of experience and what's going on. And from that, you can then, with your engineering hat on, start to say, okay, well, which of these systems can I understand, which are actually modifiable to me? Because, for example, if you go to somewhere like Myanmar, it has a very different culture to the UK. It's quite hard to understand, but I can't do anything about it as a clinician or a clinical academic. However, you can maybe do something about some of the processes that happen clinically. So you might want to take from your big, rich, messy data all the stuff that talks about patient flow and process and try and model that, and then make some recommendations with your local colleagues about what you could improve. But you've got it nicely contextualized within all that messy cultural, political, hierarchical data, because you know that actually to make any of these changes, you're going to need to go back to that, and it's going to have to make sense. And also, I got really interested in the power of stories as a end in themselves. And so that was borne out actually by one of our researchers who said at the end of the project, you know, when we started this, and she's born and raised and has lived and worked in Myanmar for her whole life, she said, when we started this, I assumed that all of the problems we had were because of resource limitation. But now I've walked around and spoken to people, I've heard all these stories from all these different people, and I realized that most of the things that are problems we can fix without any more money. There are one or two areas of obvious resource poverty, but most of our problems come from the way that communication and culture and hierarchy get in the way of patient care. And we can fix that without funding. And for me, that was that internal narrative was as much an output of the research as anything else we do. You know, it's changing the stories in people's minds about how they view the care that they give and the system they work in. And so one of the things that really led me to narrative was, not only is it a brilliant way to understand the place, but it's also a way to effect a change. Once you start changing the stories that people have in their heads, you actually start to change how things and people work. And then, you know, intellectually, it sends you off down a complete rabbit hole. I got fascinated by, you know, how the hunter-gatherers in the, you know, the Athabascan High Arctic map their trails. There's a whole load of really interesting work about how they map their lives and how they follow the game that they depend on versus the geopolitical maps that white colonialists tried to draw of their territories, and how you overlay those two things. So that interface between people's stories, how they represent them, how that helps you understand them, and then how you together, and the point is it's very mutual, effect change for the better. You know, that becomes very kind of academically navel-gazing, but to me became really interesting.
But don't you think that messiness of unstructured interviews is really intimidating? You know, I think especially, you know, in neurosurgery, where, you know, it's very kind of product driven, there's an input and an output, and actually for lots of people dipping their toe into qualitative research, just the idea of putting your toe into an open sea and seeing what happens, that's very different to putting your toe in the shallow end and doing something which is perhaps more obvious, like a semi-structured interview where, you know, semi-structured, you can have some freedom to go off and explore, but you know the data will be focused on the needs of your study, which can be quite that there's safety in that approach. So how did it feel taking that big risk and that big step to move away from what you planned to do, which was a semi-structured approach, into something which put all the power into the hands of the participant and left you feeling, would have felt maybe out of control or less in control than you would have been with a semi-structured approach?
Yeah, so I think the way that I framed it as I kind of arrived at this point was that I realized that the way the spectrum works to me depends on the data you want to create. And a lot of that depends also on, and you put it really nicely, the needs of your study and what you perceive those to be. So obviously, you know, at the far end of the kind of the reductive approach to qualitative work, you have something like a survey, which is really easy to do. It gives you very manipulatable data. You can do a p-value on it if you want to. You can do some nice statistics. It's very clean and clear.
And safe.
Very safe.
Yeah.
It completely frames the data you get in the terms of the questions you have chosen to ask. And so it's very superficial. It tells you to an extent, and if it's very well designed, you could say, argue it tells you quite well, the answers to those questions you have already decided are the right questions. At the other end of that, you have unstructured interviews, which tell you what your respondents want to tell you, which is totally different. You're right, you're way out west and you have no idea what they're going to say and you've no idea how it's going to relate back to your eventual study. But what you're getting there is the genuine viewpoint of the people whose opinions you might be interested in. And then the role I see for kind of the semi-structured interviews when you're sat in the middle, maybe you've got to a point where you've done some early work that's very messy, and either intuitively or analytically, you've used that to work out, okay, I'm pretty sure these are the questions I want to answer, but I've still got a degree of variation in those answers. There's still some freedom there to explore something interesting. And so that's where my semi-structure is going to fit. You know, it's not quite as reductive as a survey where they can only really answer the questions I've asked them. And it's not quite as random as the storytelling where they might start telling me about their grandpa and nothing to do with the research question that I thought I was asking about. And so I think there's a role for that semi-structured interview there when you're a bit clearer. And also, to be clear, the work that we did with narrative, it's not totally unstructured. It's just that the structure is very conceptual and light touch. So, for example, we did frame the stories and say, like, tell me a story of, you know, how this hospital works. Tell me a story of what you do as your job. And then within narratives, there are different ways of exploring that conceptual space. So, for example, what's interesting is when you ask people about their habitual narrative. So you say, what happens on a normal Monday? And they'll tell you, on a normal Monday, I go in and I hang up my coat and I start at 8 and then I get my thing and I get my notes and I go my ward round. And that is telling you about how that system operates at a kind of median level. That's generally what happens. Then you can ask about exceptional narratives and say, what's your best day ever and your worst day ever? And it might tell you about how that system behaves at its most extreme. When things are perfect, I walk in, everything's been done. You know, everyone's got better overnight. Enjoyable day. It's the best day ever. And, you know, and then what's the worst day? Well, the worst day was last week when, you know, the hospital caught on fire and there was a monsoon and there was a car crash. And all those things tell you about how their system, their lived environment varies between these kind of extremes. And then for me, the other exciting one is to ask people about their hypothetical narrative and say, if you had a magic wand, how would this look? What was the best this could be? Because then you're asking them to kind of push their experience of reality into a way which is not completely fanciful. You know, you're not going to say, in a perfect world, I could cure everyone with a wave of my hand. But you might say, how would this service work at its best? You know, what's the best you can imagine it? And they might say, I want to deliver the service as good as the one I saw in Boston when I went there on my 2-week visit. And you're like, okay, well, that tells me, now that tells me a huge amount because it tells me where you are, what the limits of that are, and where you think you might reasonably get to. So there's a conceptual structure there, but what you're not asking them to do is address particular questions. And that might come later. So I can really imagine a kind of a tiered approach where you start very messy, then you get to something a bit more semi-structured where you say, okay, I've pared down some of that information. Now I've got these kind of 10 domains I want to explore, and I'm going to specifically signpost them and get you to tell me about them. And then maybe if I want to do that at a much bigger scale, I might turn that into a survey later and distribute it to 1,000 people.
I think that
process is, I think, quite useful.
Yeah, I think that's what's so, you know, when we talk about the flexibility of qualitative research, that's its flexibility, and that you don't have to be constrained by a validated outcome measure that, you know, if you'd only asked a particular question, you know, but you didn't, then, you know, it doesn't do what it's supposed to do anymore. But actually, you can evolve your qualitative interview schedule to capture something that, you know, it wasn't captured before. So, you know, all of a sudden you've looked at some data and you realize that you should be asking about A and you've never asked that before. So the next participant, you can ask A and you can follow that line of inquiry. And that's a really powerful part, I think, of qualitative methods. But I think what you were saying before about this, you know, the richness of an unstructured approach and that ability to get that quality of data and that candor. And I think candor is quite an important, like, it's a key term that you use, because I don't know, there's a difference between candor and honesty, you know. And I think that you're trying to get a story, if you like, a version of an experience that they're willing to tell you, and to have them decide what it is that they share with you can have far more richer potentials for construction of data. It's just a very intimidating dating way of doing it, and I think you have to be quite confident as a researcher to allow that data to unfold. And you said there about somebody maybe talking about their grandfather, or, you know, because that's the main limitation of unstructured approach and why people shy away from it, because that intimidation for collecting a whole load of irrelevant data. So were you concerned about irrelevant data, or some people would call it dross, which I don't particularly like because I think it's all data. Did that happen, and what did you do with it?
So it happened to an extent, but I think generally what I found was that because the clinical environment is reasonably bounded and people understood we were asking about almost a very specific area of clinical care, you know, these were all people in and around traumatic brain injury care, some our patients, their families, hospital kind of auxiliary staff, so porters and kind of ambulance drivers, but also nurses and anaesthetists and surgeons and emergency physicians and all sorts. Generally, what we found was that people reasonably well bounded their stories. And the other important thing is that the people asking them about their stories were their colleagues. So this was not me as the white researcher. This was their colleague neurosurgeon and their colleague neuroanaesthetist who are getting these stories. And so in general, you know, again, you can go off on a tangent, but if you look at the way that clinicians share experience through stories, you can go to coffee rooms and, you know, doctors' messes all over the world, and people are quite used to using stories to share experience. And actually that's what people did quite readily. And so the ones that were probably most difficult to manage were the patients and their relatives. But what was interesting to me was that they told us things that were totally, totally, totally different from what the clinicians were telling us. So, you know, the single biggest problem with care that the patient's relatives discussed was the distance from the hospital campus to the local pharmacy. They were very satisfied with everything else, but what irritated them was they had to walk so far to go and buy the drugs that the hospital couldn't stock at the moment. And that didn't come out of the clinician views at all. Now, for me, that's not dross. That is perfect, because it suddenly starts to tell you that if you're really genuinely driving this towards patient care, the things that they care about are really very different to the clinical processes that are going on. And that doesn't mean the clinical processes don't need improving as well, but it just means you could improve them out of sight and your patients would still be irritated about how far they had to walk to the shops.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so for me, that dross fed back into the research study and was just as powerful data. And I think this goes back to the wider point that what I noticed from talking to engineers and designers and operational researchers and clinical researchers is that actually all of this early narrative work people do. They just don't call it research. They sometimes call it scoping. They sometimes call it you know, PPI or, you know, patient and family involvement, PFI.
Yeah,
you know,
that's true.
They've all got different pseudonyms for it. But everybody goes out and does this heuristic, intuitive information gathering. What frustrates me about it is that that is research. And what you lose if you don't call it research is you lose the rigor of thinking critically about it. So, like you said earlier, that balance between honesty and candor, the stories you're told will depend on who you are, where you're listing that story, of who, in what context, at what time, how much they trust you, how much they like you, how much they think you're one of them or not one of them.
Yeah.
And so as a researcher, you contextualize that information and say, I can draw these inferences, but I'm bounded by the fact that I am me and I'm going to get a particular story. And the risk is if you just call it scoping, what happens is all of that is unexamined bias. And you suddenly end up at your semi-structured interview with a series of questions that you have decided on with this implicit assumption that all of that early work you've done is just true. I've been out and found out about this, and now I know about it. I know what the questions are.
Mm.
And to me, that's a mistake. That's a fallacy.
Mm.
If you had framed that early narrative work as this is early narrative research, you would have had to think about who you're talking to and how you're talking to them and what they're willing to share with you and what they're not willing to share with you and what the unspoken contracts are in that discussion. And it's a problem as well, because as soon as you call it a research study, there'll be some stories people won't tell you.
Yes.
This is one of the things my research colleagues in Myanmar said very clearly. They were like, you know, there are things people will only tell me when the dictaphone's turned off.
Mm.
And I can't capture that because it's a research study. And so I'm bound by the ethics and the consent that they've given me. But what I really want to tell you is all the stuff they said over the rest of the beer after the interview finished.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so there's a challenge there in how you design your study and what you're allowed to capture and what you don't allow to be captured, and then how you show a clear methodological process between the early work and the structured work. But I think the mistake is to ignore the fact that the early work is research and should be thought about. Mm. Otherwise, what you have is a whole load of implicit biases that suddenly lead you to asking questions which make complete sense to you as a clinician, are a long way away from actually a lot of the pertinent concerns of a lot of the other people involved in, you know, the domain you're looking at. So it does raise those questions of how you do it analytically. And I'm still struggling with that I think one of the problems we have in medicine and a lot of other academic disciplines is that a huge amount of the work that's done is analytical. So if you go and look at the narratologists, they'll pick over narratives and they'll discuss how is the narrative structured? How is the story conveyed? You can look at the language that was used. You can look at the character arc. You can look at the plot development. You can look at where the narrator positioned themselves. None of that actually tells you what to do with it creatively to solve problems. And I think that's why I ended up in an engineering department, that what I really want to do is, that's all interesting. And, you know, with one bit of my brain, I want to chew over those bones and think about it all very, very much. But I also just want to get on and do something to make it better. And so the challenge is to tease out those threads that you can do something about that are practical and pragmatic. And show that, okay, I've got all that interesting stuff, but all I really need to do is tease out these five things that people have talked about again and again. And that might be resources, it might be communication, it might be clinical training, it might be institutional processes. Those are going to be the focus of what we're now going to take forward.
And I think that's possibly why we don't see huge amounts of qualitative research in medical literature, because and what we do see in the medical literature is quite fast paced, rapid turnover, quicker analytical techniques, because that thinking takes time, and a lot of there's so many demands pragmatically on clinicians doing, you know, dipping their toe in, that we're kind of possibly missing a trick to try and get more involved in the in-depth stuff. But just wondered if you could, just to finish off with a last question, so what tips would you give anyone thinking about using an unstructured interview method in their study?
So there's some things to think about. Purely pragmatically, you have to have a bunch of researchers who are happy doing it. And then that takes some preparatory time. So that means you need to either, if you're not doing it yourself, and I I really advise people to do it with a range of researchers, because the whole point is that different people get different stories. And there's a fascination in comparing the story you got with comparing the story that your colleague got.
That's interesting.
From quite similar people. So it really lends itself to a multidisciplinary research team. And if you're working cross-culturally, so a North-South or a South-South collaboration, it's brilliant to try and do it where everybody has a go. And then you see the different stories that people get in different conditions. But all those people need to have thought it through a little bit together and understand why you're using this approach and be happy with it. And some of that is in character. So you need people who are happy sitting down and taking an hour or 2 hours or 3 hours to just sit there and have a chat with people and to foster that understanding and that trust and that bond, which allows people to story share. There's also a pragmatic issue about getting the right ethical approval. And it's worth noting that a lot of ethical approval boards in medicine will expect to see semi-structured interviews.
Yes.
You know, they want to see the questions you're going to ask. And so sometimes there's a degree of game playing to be done there, where you say, I'm going to ask these questions, and you think carefully about how those questions are presented and structured that still gives you the opportunity to ask around them and to essentially deconstruct them a bit and go as free-form and as narrative as you like. Or to look at social science ethical review boards, and that's what I did. So I got a humanities and social sciences ethical review board to look over my proposal, as well as a medical review board, so that I had a dual perspective. And actually I also had an engineering ethical review board, and that was all quite useful because it made me feel like I had covered multiple bases. And then I think you have to have a careful think about what you want to do methodologically to make sense of the data. And this is a bugbear that I think is worth noting for anybody interested in qualitative research in medicine, is that when I look at probably 95% of the qualitative research I see in medicine, it pays a lot of attention to claiming a methodological rigor in terms of how it analyzed the data. People will always claim a grounded theory, constant comparative approach to data. I don't see how any of it can really be grounded theory, because that to me implies that you have no underlying knowledge about your data. And we have an enormous amount of underlying knowledge about our data, which is why we've gone and got it in the first place. And so people then do thematic analyses, and they count up the number of times things were said, and they present five or six themes back. And often those five or six themes don't really change your understanding any more than a review of the existing literature would have done. And what they haven't paid attention to is the quality of the data they got in the first place. So all those issues of how is this data created, by whom, how is it situated, how is this data constructed, how does that bound it, how does that bias it? To me, that's the bedrock. Because once you've got that data, you can pick any analytical technique you like. You've got it saved, you've got the transcripts, you've got the audio files. You can do any kind of analysis on it you like, and you can pick and choose, but make sure the data's good. Because I think the disaster is that you say, I did six semi-structured interviews where I asked six people like me the six questions I'd already thought of, and they all said the same sort of answers, and I came out with these six themes, and that's now the answer. And you think, well, that's nonsense, isn't it? You know, the methodological approach might be good, but what you've produced is just an echo chamber that, you know, that will not change the debate. Whereas if you'd got really solid data at the start, then as you pull through, every other stage will be much better informed and much more likely to actually change the debate. So my strong advice is think really hard about that foundational data, because it's the data that matters. And then all the methodological techniques you can pick up off the shelf, you can get someone to help you with, and you can then think creatively about whether you can really justify a thematic analysis, or if you even need to. I think one of the things which we're not good at is saying, and one of the joys, I think, of narrative approaches is just saying, I as an individual have heard all these stories, and this is now what I as an individual think. And I actually don't need to show you the whys and the wherefores and the paper trails, because I can't. All I can tell you is that my internal narrative, having been through this research process, is now this. And I think we could be a bit more confident about saying that as qualitative researchers, and just saying, you know, I can unpick it. You know, I can have 10 years of therapy to unpick why I think what I think for the thing I've heard. But for the purposes of understanding my research question, I don't need to. I just need to present it and justify it by showing you the particular quotes that have informed it, the particular images people created, excerpts from the particular stories which have shaped my understanding. This is now why I think what I think. And so I would urge people not to be afraid of that creative leap. I think better data and less of a focus on a restrictive methodological analysis will actually lead to more interesting and better qualitative research. Like, that's my strong feeling.
Good. That's a really good point to stop. So thank you so much for chatting to us today. It's been a real pleasure just chewing over some interesting qualitative methodological issues. So thank you again, Tom.
Thanks very much for having me. Cheers.
All right. Welcome back, everybody. So that was a great podcast chatting to Tom. I think what was really nice talking to him was picking up on a method that not everybody uses. So it is quite uncommon for people to opt for unstructured interviews. And it was good to get his take on why he chose to use that. So what did you take away from the interview, Brandon?
I think coming from having done semi-structured interviews, I think the idea of unstructured interviews was really, to me at least, was quite a scary thing to think about, is going in without any, I suppose, in semi-structured interviews you'd have an interview guide or a schedule. I think that was the first thing that really stuck out to me, is how would you do that? It's daunting. It really is daunting because you have the research question that you want to answer, and obviously you have your sources, you have your participants. And I think trying to connect those two together without any structure is a feat. It's definitely a feat.
I think the word we used was intimidating in the podcast, and I think it is intimidating. But it is so liberating in so many ways, kind of give it, and Tom talked a lot about power and power hierarchies, and to kind of give over that power to your participants and put them in control. It really changes the nature of research and how you see the people that you interview, whether you see them as a means to gather data to answer something that you're interested in, which is the traditional way that we do research, or you see them as a partner co-creating something. And you're never completely it's never completely open. Like, you don't just kind of sit there and ask about nothing. He did talk about framing questions. You still have tell me about your best day or your worst day or, your hypothetical day. They're still constructed around the thing that you're interested in. So, I've done unstructured interviews. I did those for my PhD. And similarly, I asked family members to talk about the injury of their relative. I think the framing question is something like, and all the events and experiences that are important to you personally, begin wherever you like. I'll listen first. I won't interrupt. And then that's it. And some people are really comfortable with that. I had somebody talk for over two hours without me asking a follow-up question. And then other people are like, you need to give me a question. I don't know what to tell you. I don't know what you need. You need to be prepared for both ways, but
I was gonna say, I think that's you sort of hit nail on the head with, but in terms of the investment that the participant has in your research question or in your line of inquiry, I think it's going to heavily influence their participation. Because if you have someone who has a rich story and they're interested in sharing that, then of course you're going to have a really good conversation despite not asking any questions. I think the key word there is conversation rather than a question and answer session. Whereas, I found it in my research in the past as well, even when using semi-structured interviews, it's quite difficult to get, to get an answer, not necessarily an answer, you get an answer, but to get an elaboration of the true thoughts and feelings about the question you just asked. Still can be difficult. And when you've got a semi-structured interview schedule, You have to adapt that, or you're going to get through the whole schedule of perhaps 10, 20 questions in sort of 5 minutes. I think you really have to set the scene for the participant in the sense that, this is a conversation. It's not an interview. It's not like an interrogation. It has to be a conversation. Because then you both come in with an awareness of what in what your sort of duty is as the researcher and the researched. And I think it then, you know, STEM instruction interviews still have this difficult value, because I mean, you can work around them, you can add to them, you can remove bits from them. But no, I really do see the value of unstructured interviews then, especially when you're coming in not really knowing what you want to ask, but you have a question in mind, but you don't know how all the different, I suppose, grains of inquiry that you want to piece together. And I think it's having an unstructured approach, I think, really allows that to come out on its own and to shape the answer to that research question.
Yeah, and I think you do have to be quite careful, and they're not for everybody. And I think a semi-structured interview is really great in most cases, you know, because you are, lots of the questions that we're interested in are, you know, are focus questions. We have a particular agenda. I think you need to acknowledge that and own that, you know, and be aware of the agenda that you have when you're asking the interview or developing your interview schedule. But when you can take a sit back, you know, sit back and say, actually, I just want to explore this. I really just want to see from their perspective what this is like. I really don't have an agenda. I don't have, you know, anything hidden. That's where, you know, unstructured interviews can be really promising, because, you know, they feel, if you allow participants to feel like that, they'll tell you all sorts of stuff that you had no idea about, that you were never expecting. You certainly couldn't have preempted an interview question that would ask them about that thing. But I think it is really important. They're not, you know, they're not to be used lightly, and they're not actually appropriate for lots of studies. But when you really want that exploratory approach and value the divergence in experiences, then actually the unstructured approach can be really, really powerful.
I think something he alluded to, well, I don't think he mentioned directly, but something he alluded to is having that rapport there with the participants in the first place helps. Because you know, he mentioned that some of the best conversations you have, you know, are typically away from
off tape,
more clinical setting. You know, they're going to be off tape, or, you know, how the conversations will differ in context. If you, in the coffee room of a, you know, of a ward to a conference, to over dinner or you know, any other form of beverage, it changes perhaps it doesn't change the scope, but it changes the response that you might get.
Absolutely. There has if you read Irving Goffman's work, it talks about, like, you know, the mask that you wear. So, you know, if you're in a conversation with somebody that you perceive as being hierarchically, you know, more important than you are, you will tell them a different type of story than you would tell to one of your family members. And this is where we start thinking about, well, what's the truth? And actually, all of those different stories are true. You just tell them in a very different way, and you prioritize different bits of information depending on the setting. And that's why one of the key things that Tom was talking about is actually the quality of the data. You know, if you get the quality of the data right, analytically, you can do all sorts of things. But if you know, if you don't think about things like, well, where am I interviewing them? You know, how long have I got? Are they rested? Are they comfortable? Do they see me as a peer or somebody who's more powerful than them? How do I, you know, we don't talk enough about rapport building. You know, when you read the papers that are published in journals, all they do is they'll say, you know, the interview lasted 60 minutes, 90 minutes. They very rarely tell you about the pre-consent meeting that happened. So the time that was spent talking about the study and for that person to meet you and kind of get the measure of you as a researcher and what you might be interested in. And that's that whole kind of, you know, that kind of storming process of, you know, who are they? What do they want from me? Am I comfortable here? What am I going to tell them? And actually, that's really, really important interpretive kind of work, so that when you come and you actually turn the, you know, the recording on, it's not just, you know, I'm going straight in for the kill on my big question. There's all this preparatory journey to get to that point. And I don't think we don't talk enough about that. But actually, if they are comfortable and happy, you know, even if you look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs, if you do at the base level of feeling safe and comfortable, people relax, you know, you can noticeably see people, you know, people's shoulders drop as they, and they relax back into their chair. They have a cup of tea and they're all of a sudden they're talking to you and they're much more comfortable. And that's where the richness of data comes in. So they're not just telling you the obvious stuff, they're telling you the contextual stuff. That's how I see it.
Yeah, I'm trying to think back, because there's a point I'm trying to remember. I think it's in the, is it the Co-Reg guidelines, where they ask about the interview setting. And I think as a researcher, you're sort of obliged to give this answer of, oh, it was done in a locked office, you know, with soundproof walls and no one could hear you, and so on and so forth. But I think you really limit yourself to the responses that you might get in doing it in that way. You know, if you don't want to set up like you're in a police station in an interrogation room
Even a medic, like a clinic room. I find clinic rooms are very intimidating.
It isn't intimidating. I think there's definitely a degree of considering about the participant, you know, asking them, well, where are you going to feel most comfortable during this interview and what form, what time, and so on and so forth. I mean, I remember when I did my qualitative semi-structured interviews, it's very much building around the participant, you know, what time zone works best. I think you really limit them if you can say, oh, I can only do between 12 and 3 in British time. And so then that might be in the middle of a ward round. Or it might be out of hours and they've just finished a day. And you're going to get different responses at both of those times, because their degree of interaction is going to change. They're going to have a different investment. And purely because of the fact, you know, they're going to be tired, they're not going to want to have this big, often intense conversations about, you know, their work and so on. So I think there's definitely a degree of reporting that should be done with respect to that, sort of beyond the, oh, we did it in a locked room, you know, soundproof walls.
Maybe not locked.
Brandon. Maybe not locked.
Participants are allowed to leave.
They're allowed to leave, of course. But there needs to be reported, because again, as you said, it affects the data, and I don't think you're doing the paper or the output justice if you're not reporting that particular stage. It's sort of reflectivity, isn't it? It's good practice.
And I think that the big thing is going back to Tom's point about data quality, that actually if you put all these restrictions in place with your participant, you know, only at this time, only in these places, only for this period of time, actually you're squashing that participant, if you like, and their story, and controlling the means by which they tell that story. And if you can open all of that up, you know, you will get much better data, much, much better data.
So I think that
it is key, you know, what Tom was saying about the better qualitative research comes from better data. Then on top of that, you can then do rigorous analytical techniques.
Exactly.
And I think the other thing that I just wanted to pick up on from his interview was this idea of, I think he said this, that we're missing a trick in, you know, doing this preparatory work and not having that kind of rigorous, systematic, analytical time with the data. And I think I'm, you know, a big advocate for analysing data properly, you know, spending that time with it. And instead of doing, I mean, I do see PPI and qualitative research as different things. They serve different purposes. And sorry, I should just say PPI, so participant and public, what is it, public and patient involvement?
Yes.
So this is where where you would ask for basically consultancy, isn't it, to design your study correctly or better. So I do see those as two different things, but I think if you're collecting qualitative data, the opportunity to spend time with it and, you know, rigorously analyze, systematically analyze that data and come up with something that you wouldn't have seen if you'd have just, you know, scanned through it, that's there's a big opportunity there, I think.
Yeah, exactly right.
So that's all really I wanted to pick up on with Tom's interview. Did you have anything else that you wanted to chat about today?
Nothing comes to mind. I think that's a good overview. It's worth listening to the podcast, get the full picture.
Yeah, it's a great podcast. And I think, you know, as we progress through the NeuroCore podcast, it's good to pick up on methods, really, and different ways of collecting data, different ways of, you know, recruiting people. So I think we'll do more of that as we progress. So thank you so much for joining us today. We'll look forward to you tuning in again soon. Bye, everyone.